You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Scott Guild was the lead singer and guitarist and songwriter in New Collisions, a Boston art pop band that toured with the B-52s and opened for Blondie. His work has appeared in Time, on NPR, in Literary Hub, Magnet, and other venues, where he's written about the carceral state, the climate crisis, and growing up bisexual in the 1990s. He is now a professor of creative writing at Marion University in Indianapolis. He is also an advocate for prison reform, serving for years as the assistant director of Penn City Writers, a creative writing program for students imprisoned in Texas, and teaching in Indiana's women's prison. His new novel is a Plastic, and there's an album version of Plastic out now through Sony Music and North Street Records. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. I'm looking forward to this.
You know, we've talked a couple of times, but in the past couple of weeks, things have changed so radically.
Yes.
Parts of your book have just become even more poignant and pointed. Let's just begin with a brief description, I guess. Oof. I might say that this is the book that Philip K. Dick would have written had he lived to, say, 2050. To the year 2050 to see all of his earlier predictions come unfortunately true.
Well, that's a compliment. I appreciate that. But also, yeah, I think just for the last month, it's like, oh, your book is so prescient and insightful. You know, hearing that, you're like, I wish it wasn't. But thank you for saying, I mean, it's very kind of you to say it. Yeah,
one of the things that as I first started out this book, I was thinking of not the science fiction genre, which this is a part of, but of the fantasy genre. And the reason is because there are considered two kinds of fantasies. There's a first world fantasy, which takes place essentially nominally in our world. Harry Potter is a good example of that. And then there's what's called second world fantasy, where it, like Lord of the Rings, where it's not our world. There are some resemblances. Maybe they call it Middle Earth. But there's no direct, like, highway that will take you from our world to Middle Earth, whereas there is for Harry Potter. It's just our world with all sorts of witches and magic technology. As I started Plastic, I was wondering what kind of science fiction your book, your world was. In a sense, for example, like Star Trek eventually showed its hand and gave us the through line from our world to the Star Trek 23rd century. Dune never does that. Dune just says, okay, here we are, and you got to take it as the way it is. Did you know whether or not you're going to have a through line to our world? Maybe like a neck-choking noose to our world?
Well, I have to apologize just at the outset, because with technology never being our friend, you froze for maybe like 30 seconds of what you were saying. So I think, let me repeat back. We don't have to go through the question again. I don't want to make you do all that editing later, but let me just repeat back what I think you're asking. And if I'm on the right track, does that sound good?
Yeah, sounds great.
I'm so sorry about whatever is going on with the computers. I'm hearing you saying, almost asking, like, did I know when I started out writing the book that I wanted to write something that was going to be essentially in a separate world from our own, and maybe referencing back to it, as opposed to writing something that was totally separate from our world with no connective links? Is that kind of what you're getting
exactly,
at?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. And I think when I started out writing the book, I knew that I wanted to write something that had some wisp of, like, this is where our world plausibly could go in the future. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I was only really able to feel personally, kind of emotionally connected to the world once I made it very, very strange and alternate. In a sense, it's kind of hard to describe in a way, where when I'm writing at least, or when I'm reading stuff, it's like I almost want everything to like hurt a little bit. So, the way I think of where our world is going, I think of it largely in terms of pain. I think there's so much beauty and grandeur and mystery and love in life, but what we human beings have decided to do with our world and the type of trajectories we've allowed to continue, to me feels like, gosh, just like, like some sort of syringe jabbing into the back of my neck. I mean, I think we said before we started talking that we're both in kind of weird moods with the news cycle, so I'm just going to lean into that today. So, I mean, I think that's it. I think I kept trying to write dystopian worlds, and it just kept feeling like a genre exercise or a kind of cerebral prediction of where things might go. And it was only when I took all the organs out of the characters' bodies so that, they're in a terror attack and someone gets their head blown off and there's nothing in the basin of their skull and they have creaking hinges all the time, that I kind of felt, this is right to me, at least. Like, this is how it feels. That, not in the sense that, oh, I feel like we're all hollow and empty people necessarily, but that, you have to try to render your emotions when you're writing fiction, and you have to try to go in as deep as you can to the level of kind of horror and disgust, as a baseline. So that's something I'd say with the next book I'm writing too. That's something I'm trying to figure out how to do in new ways, and get to a sense of how the world feels to me right now. And that's the world building. And then into that, you try to put characters who are living full, meaningful lives. I don't think of myself as like a cynical person. I'm a person of faith in many ways. So I'm not trying to write stuff that's just about how horrible the world is. But I guess I'd like to start from a place where I'm not sugarcoating it for myself. And then, and I think because I spend most of my time in my life writing fiction, there's a sense in which, like, if I'm lying to myself in what I'm writing, or I'm trying to make it too simple and easy, I'm kind of losing my soul or myself. So there's a real pressure to be kind of honest and real on the page that, I just think, there's something to be said for like where you put your attention is how you sort of define yourself. So this relationship you have to the page and what you're creating ends up being really important. So it's interesting in a moment like this where you feel like, gosh, I don't think fiction is going to save the world in any kind of direct way, but if we can drill down and try to be as honest and direct as we can about the moment we're living in and what feels really human to us, maybe that'll help ourselves to grow, help somebody else. It's hard to know what helps and what changes things when things get so dark like they are right now.
Well, I think one of the things that your book does extremely well is to use the tools of genre fiction, the toolkit, to externalize and rebuild exactly our world, because that's the world we live in. But to change the shape of it by using, saying, okay, here we're going to imagine this, and we're going to imagine this technology, and we're going to be immersive in that technology, and we're going to extend that so that you can use those devices to externalize the kind of inner torments all of us feel living in the world that we live in. That, we don't need no thinking bodies and extras to, extra technology to feel terrible. We're doing a good job of making ourselves feel terrible with comparatively low technology.
Right, exactly.
Now, one of the things I think that is really important in this book are the characters, Aaron and Fiona and Max and Owen. I mean, in the beginning, we see them in this kind of existing in a world that is a kind of a cartoon of itself and of ours. But as we get to know them and get pulled into them, their lives are really deeply affecting it. And this book is incredibly poignant in many ways. And I
Thank
think
you.
that that is part of the plotting of the book. Could you talk about plotting the poignancy arc of your novel?
It's interesting. I think it connects a lot to what we were just talking about a moment ago, where it's very, I feel like it's very easy to just mock the world when it's bad, or just to say, look at how terrible everything is. And I mean, I think there can be poignancy in that, and just sort of rendering the darkness and the pain, or just pointing a finger at it and saying how terrible it is. I think the harder thing, or at least for me, the more challenging thing is to see how awful the world is and then try to locate that same darkness and those same impulses in yourself. I think when you're, it's so easy to just be so judgy about the world and then not realize, okay, but wait, like, who am I the one doing the judging? What am I really like inside and so forth? So I think I started out writing a book that was very, cynical in some ways, very satirical in some ways, but the book always felt a little thin to me, or like it was just sort of going through the motions and a little one note in terms of its tone and everything. So, yeah, I mean, but at the same time, I had these characters I was writing who were very alienated and very unhappy and angry and so forth. I'm imagining someone's listening to this and thinking this must be the most depressing book of all time. And I mean, it's a comedy, really, in a lot of ways. It's not, I think
It
I'm not in as much a comedy mood today, so maybe I'm not serving the book as well as I could be in this interview. But yeah, so I think when you're when I was feeling that way about those characters, then it was time to dig in and think, like, okay, what trauma shaped these characters to be who they are? Like, what are the formative experiences that created this life in these characters? And then that wasn't just the stuff in the society. It was the loss of Erin's loss of her father. It was the broken relationship with her sister. It was her own obsessiveness and haunted feelings about love. And a lot of those, I mean, in the book, she has an extended relationship with a virtual, like, AI boyfriend at one point. And I've never, thankfully had that happen to me in my life. But in many ways, like the loss of a parent and so forth does mirror the stuff that's happened to me in my own life and family estrangement and things like that. So digging into that was really a pathway into thinking, okay, like, now I can sort of see the emotional arcs my characters are going through, and trying to understand how the characters are going to heal and grow and change through that. I look at how that's happened in my own life and so forth. And then the book stopped being as much about, like, look at how terrible our world is, and look, we can laugh at it and mock it, and a little bit more of, yeah, the world's in a rough place. In many ways, we can laugh at just the hurt, the terrible ironies of how sad the moment is, but also, like, we can still be on this journey of personal change and so forth. So I think, for me, I feel like the book ends in a hopeful place, in the sense of how the characters change and how they grow and evolve, even though the world doesn't really get better in any way. I think in a lot of ways it probably gets much, much worse by the end. But I guess that's sort of the point, that our humanity is stronger at a sort of individual or family or even, like, group level than the terrible forces that might impact it. That there's something in us that survives and is stronger and is sort of spiritually rich, no matter what technology or awful world events get thrown at it. Yeah.
Well, boy, that is beautifully said. Thank you. That really, I think, and that speaks well for the
Thanks.
book, which also, I mean, that this is not to interrupt the hilarity through it, and I love what you've done with the avatars that people encounter, the advertising avatars, because as we're already partway there.
Yeah.
If you make the mistake of scrolling through Facebook, you'll get all sorts of targeted advertising right in your face.
Oh,
And
yes. Yes, they know you. They're watching. They might even be recording. Hopefully not. Gosh.
it's probably we don't have the storage for all the audio yet, but it's close. That's why they
That's
want all those data farms out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, geez.
One of the things I'd like you to talk about is creating the one of the brilliant part of the of this book is the way the narrative goes into and out of fiction within and inside the world, and so that there are parts that take place in the nuclear family that, as you read, they're very enjoyable and kind of satiric. You have this great kind of Christ, talking Christ figure on a cross.
Morris.
Morris,
I actually had an event last night and someone said, "Which character do you feel closest to in your book other than the main character?" I had to be honest, it was the It was Morris. Yeah, it really was. Yeah. I don't know why.
I can see why I like Morris. He's a great character. But one of the things that struck me was this is the plotting of this is very intricate. Could you talk about making those decisions? Did you like map out that these parts of the narrative will just tell the story that's within the made up story within the book, and then they'll slowly evolve into something that's referential to the story of the characters? Was that like, because it's very beautifully done, it's subtly done, and it's just, it turns out, you know, very powerfully, emotionally powerful.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, my wife and I are huge kind of lifer fans of Kazuo Ishiguro. And I hope I didn't just mispronounce his first name, because that would be, it's sad when you mispronounce the name of someone, who a writer you love so much. But he does this incredible thing in his books where there are twists in his books, you know, like almost like twists that would be in a thriller, but they're kind of emotional twists where the characters have been deluding themselves or misrepresenting themselves to themselves throughout the story. And then as they start to unpack their trauma and they start to become more self-aware, something that's been presented earlier in the book changes in the reader's understanding. You've seen the world one way, and then as the reader and as the character changes, all of a sudden there's this swap. So he was doing that from his very first book. He has this incredible book called A Pale View of Hills. Have you ever read that?
No, though I have a copy, a signed first edition on my...
You have a signed first edition of that? Oh my gosh. Well, we can talk later about how much you want for that. That's one of my favorite books, and you know, I teach it and everything all the time. And you know, and it's the same in Never Let Me Go, or even in Remains of the Day, and through a lot of his books. So I was very influenced by that sense of, you know, if you can have something that you present in your book and the reader takes it in one way based on where the character is, and then you kind of have this earned twist later in the book where, okay, the character has grown and changed, and now you're going to realize that this TV show you were watching throughout the book and these kind of mini episodes, and you'd understand one way, now that the character has changed a bit, now here's this whole new understanding. I feel like that twist can be deeply, deeply satisfying, kind of like at an emotional level. So that's what I was going for. And I mean, you know, it's interesting to think of it because it's not that different than like Gone Girl or any thriller where there's like a big twist, but you're trying to take that twist. And this isn't to knock Gone Girl, which I actually haven't read, but I'm thinking of the movie. But you're trying to take that idea of like the twist or the shift and have it kind of mirror the character's own deep emotional shift in a way. So I guess I was going for that feeling in the book. And just also a sense that when you're plotting a book, you know, if you have a through line through the book that's like, here's a character facing challenges and there's more and more challenges, it can be so satisfying if you feel the grounds of the reality of the book shifting underfoot as well. So I really like that feeling, and I was trying to do that in a lot of ways. Now, in terms of the composition of the book, no, I did not just sit down and think, oh, I'll do this. It was the result of years of trial and error. And the stuff where the TV show changes, that was actually even after the book sold. I was working on that with my editor and coming up with those ideas. So it was a journey to get the book to where all that stuff was happening. And I'm so glad to hear that you found it satisfying and it made sense, because when you're doing that sort of thing too, you're worried that, you know, if you're not signaling and cueing in the reader as they're going along, that it's just going to be totally baffling and incomprehensible, you know. So I appreciate, you know, so much what you're saying.
One of the things that I love about this book is it's fairly short. It's a pretty quick read, but there's so much. You manage to pack a lot into it, and so there are a lot of approaches that you can take it to it as a reader. You know, you can read it as a kind of, you know, a Philip K. Dick thing. You can read it as a Kazuo Ishiguro's character study. You can also read it, alas and quite unfortunately, as a bit of a, you know, predictive, here comes the future, science fiction.
Here comes the future.
To my regret. One of the, you know, a subject that rises up early and often in this book is terrorism. And there's a couple interesting aspects of terrorism in this book. And this has to go in a sense also, it's one-on-one with crime books also, that when you when somebody commits a crime or when there's a crime that turns into, whether it's an act of terrorism or, you know, some serial killer, we have the immediate victims. And, you know, it's sad for the people who die. Sounds really trite, but, you know, that's a whole complex thing. But I think one of the things this book talks about really effectively is that the people who know killers or terrorists in their everyday lives, and there've got to be some people who know them because they don't live alone. They have to go to the grocery store. You know, their lives are turned upside down in an instant when, you know, this is somebody you saw periodically at the bar or somebody you saw at the grocery store or down at the beach walking turned out to be like a kind of a human monster, at least from your view. Talk about creating this sort of sympathy for the friends of the devil.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I wanted there to be this tension in the book where, on the one hand, the eco or eco terrorists, they are the most ethical people in this society because they're the ones who have actually decided to leave the society and all its comforts and security and essentially launch a kind of revolution, a very desperate, you know, hard to launch revolution when you have this level of military buildup in all these nations where they're just trying to tear down the civilization that's destroying the planet, and they're doing it for the future of the species, right? So, I mean, they are in the immediate moment killing a lot of people and creating a lot of havoc and mayhem. But in a sense, they're trying to save life, more life in the long term, right? So they're trying to do something evil in or awful, right, or disruptive to create a good.
The ends are justifying those means.
To them, they would think of it that way, right? And also using the rhetoric of war that's always there, where it's like, well, it's a war. Like, what war could be more justified than a war for the planet and the species itself, right? Like, we fight wars all the time over territorial disputes. We fight wars for so many reasons throughout history. In a way, the war that the eco-terrorists are fighting is more just than really pretty much, you know, I mean, I think you could think of wars that are in, like, defense of an endangered person, you know, or a group like in World War II or something. But so I think they feel very justified in their own right. At the same time, committing these acts of murder, and this is the question the book is asking, even if you're justified, even if the means justify the end or whatever, you still have to live through that and be a person doing it. So that character Fiona is a terrorist who finds that she can't really do, she believes strongly in the terrorist cause, but she can't really do it because at the end of the day, she is, you know, not even ethical in the abstract. I think in her own thinking, she's unethical because she won't kill. The ethical thing would be to go into war. It's almost like if somebody found that they were going to go fight the Nazis, but they couldn't bear the act of killing Nazis or something like that. You know, I think she's in that space. So I wanted that tension to live in the book just because that's the tension I feel in our own world, which is, you know, we've built up technology and these destructive capacities in our society to the point that to tear it down is actually would be an insanely violent, chaotic, horrific thing to do. You know, and so what's going to matter more? The spiritual value of we need to be loving towards each other in every action and resist and always push against violence, or we need to embrace violence to, you know, to get to a certain end. So, I mean, the book isn't meant to give an answer about that. It's meant to just sort of like let you feel the charge of where we are in that moment. And, you know, yeah.
Well, the book also shows the events right after a fulcrum point, which we'll leave concealed, wherein a democracy is like, you know, gets a crash course in how to become a fascist state. So
I'm only laughing because it's you might as well be talking about the New York Times today. Like, I think we're not even talking about my
Yeah.
We might as well just be listening to the Daily, you know, or that's a New York Times podcast. I don't know that I'm obsessed with, but yeah, anyway. Yeah.
So, you were creating this world not too long ago, over the past 8 years, maybe. Is that right?
Well, I started writing the book, I mean, in its early forms in about 2013. Yeah. So I guess in a sense, yeah, I was. And then I wrapped up work with it maybe somewhere in 2023. So, yeah. So it was about over. There were a lot of breaks in there and other projects I worked on. But yeah. Oh, it sort of came all together over the course of about 10 years. And what a 10 years. Oh, my gosh. Just in terms of seeing everything change. And then my own life actually growing a lot and healing as a person and doing a lot better. Like, I think I ended those 10 years in a much better place than I expected. So it was kind of like my life went like this and the world went. I don't know. And I don't know what to make of all of it, you know, but.
I mean, there are some very eerie aspects of this book with regards to today in terms of people being held without, you know, without being charged, people being put on lists where they're watched and not allowed to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say, it seems like, you know, you should have been there on the staff of the Project 2025 book.
Wait, what do you mean? I should have been. I should have worked on Project 2025, as you're saying.
Yeah, you had a lot of good ideas. This book shows that you have a lot of good ideas that they could have really used.
Because as I was sitting around in like 2019, brainstorming all the dystopian things that could be done, a lot of it.
So talk about hopefully, that. You know,
hopefully
dystopian.
They don't do all of it. But yeah, you know. But I don't think I put anything in there that other societies or states haven't done. I mean, maybe I amplified it a bit because our technology is so advanced. But yeah, those types of surveillance and holding without charging and things like that. Yeah.
Well, I think, too, that this is an excellent example of using the technology that you create to externalize the internal fears that you are feeling and sensing around you. And using that technology to create, you know, a page turning plot, because it's so weird. I was going back and rereading parts of the book today, and I felt like it was interesting because I'm reading a book that's set in a kind of, you know, unknown and unknowable future, yet it feels like I'm racing towards, you know, the headlines of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is, I think, where science fiction does its finest work, where it uses the tools, the literary tools, to expose the emotional and, you know, intellectual underpinnings of the society. And it's the same way that, you know, 1984... took apart, you know, England in 1948 when the book was written. And here, there's a rumor, and it's kind of gone back and forth, that Orwell wanted to call the book 1948, but they said no.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and what you're talking about, too, makes me think of, you know, how do we conceptualize or think about what is the role of fiction, or what does fiction do? You know, is it entertainment? Is it a form of entertainment that's meant to push us towards abstract thought? Is it a space where a writer pushes certain ideas at the reader and tries to convince them? Like, I think of 1984 as a very polemical novel, in the sense that I feel like it's making kind of an argument about, this is what can happen, this is what can be done. I mean, I think there is a very emotional love story at the core of 1984. But when I think back of it and my reading experience of it, I feel like that societal critique is what's really like being driven home. And, you know, with the last line, like, he loved Big Brother, you know, it's, you're almost left to, it feels like it's trying to leave you in a place where you're very unsettled about the state of the world. And it's almost like a call to action, you know? And so I don't know what it says about my own book or about fiction in this moment that I almost, if I read science fiction today and I feel like the writer is just trying to drive home a political point, I almost feel like, well, it's not just that I've seen this done before, but almost in a way that I'm not drawn in as deeply. Like, I want the human side of it. I want the sort of Marilyn Robinson of it all even more than I want, you know, the societal critique. So, yeah, so I just wonder where, you know, when we're in a moment like this, which does feel, you know, like we are in a kind of dystopian space, or it feels like if you were to write a book in 2005 that was about this 2025, it would be labeled as a dystopian work of fiction, right? So here we are as writers, or, you know, interviewers, journalists, you know, thinkers, as in this moment. And it's like, what is the fiction here to change the world? Is it just here to let us really feel what's going on? I mean, I think maybe that's something that I feel, one of the things I think strongly that it does is it, stories let us actually access the deepest level, our deepest level of emotions of things, and then there's something moving forward. So I'd be curious for your thoughts on that, because you just talk to writers all the time. Yeah, and I'm not trying to say I think I have answers about this either. I just think fiction does so many things. Yeah, power.
I agree with you that this book helps inform us that we are living in what Stanislaw Lem called the pericalypse, which is the apocalypse that came to pass back in, say, let's just throw a date out, 2016. Only everybody was so inflamed with what was going on in 2016, we didn't notice that our world had ended. And, you know, it went, the apocalypse that goes unnoticed in a general haste. And what this book, in creating this kind of dystopian world that seems so much like ours, and the emotions of the people who live within it seem so much like ours. And that's where your real, I think, success and the power of this novel is, that once we get swept up in the emotions of Aaron and Fiona and Owen and Max, and it becomes really personal. And I think you do a really good job too of bringing in things that really are not direct. But the other power of this book is that a lot of the character action and arcs are based on things that are not directly relevant to the pericalypse, which is, for example, you know, the death of the parent, taking it and taking some care of somebody who is dying. And I think that the emotional power in that is you know, what makes the rest of it really work and feel real, allows us to inhabit your world as if it's our world, because we have so much emotionally in common with the characters there. Talk about creating the emotions in those scenes, you know, caring for the dying parent. It's that's a powerful portion of the book.
Yeah. And I'm so glad to hear you say all this, because I think sometimes when you're writing fiction, you can kind of feel like you're off in your room playing with your toys and like the world's burning around you. And you're like, well, here I got my like Lincoln Logs and my Lego blocks. And I was that kind of kid, you know, where I just would, only child, obviously, and then, you know, obviously, and, you know, playing with my toys and so forth. And I think writing fiction is kind of a form of play in a way, or I feel like I can see a through line in my life from sitting there with my Legos to now sitting there with my sentences, tinkering with them. But you're trying to create a form of play now that invites others in to your space. And the play is meant to be about, you know, the deepest things you've felt or experienced or something. So, yeah, I mean, I think in my late 20s, you know, I was very, very close to my stepmother. In many ways, she was just like a second mother to me and really like the best person I've ever known. And she passed away very suddenly of a very extreme form of cancer. And I was there for the last, like, you know, 6 weeks of home hospice and everything. So trying to get that on the page, and when that came into the book a bit later, those scenes where Aaron is caring for her father and seeing him pass away, and suddenly a space is opening up because death is approaching, that they can talk about things with a raw honesty that they haven't had before. That was really kind of cleansing to me, to be able to write those things. And yeah, fiction, even as much as I sit around writing it, it's still so mysterious to me, the sense that, you know, when you take something from your real life and then fictionalize it and put it in a different world, you're wrought with it in the same way again. I'm working on a short story right now too, that's very weird, but is also just in many ways entirely about some like sexual abuse I had when I was a little kid. And it's just, I mean, you know, so I'm in there playing with my toys still in a way, but it's intense, and you hope that's leading somewhere and that you're not just gonna go insane. But I mean, I cannot say how much it means to hear that this came across to you as a reader when you're reading it, because you know, you feel like if the world is going to survive these kind of moments, it's because there's some kind of authentic feeling that we can share between each other, some sort of honest communication, and the empathy that evolves out of that has a path for it. So I don't know that that's like a philosophy of like fiction save. You know, I'm not trying to like create some, you know, manifesto about that or anything, but there's this hope that is still there, and it feels very spiritual and real to me.
Well, also too, I mean, not to put too fine a point upon it, amidst all the emotion, there's a lot of fun and I think really great humor. And I think it's interesting that you observe your own humor when you do some of the nuclear family out calls with Morris. Because also because too, there's a laugh track that you talk about, and sometimes the characters crack jokes that as outside readers we think, well, that's, you know, that's awful. It's funny, but it's really awful, and you note
There's one
that in
moment in
the
the book.
laugh
There's one
track.
moment in the book where they make a joke and someone laughs, and then the other people on the laugh track shush the person. Like, no, that's not a joke. That's not appropriate. One of the happiest things for me was in the audiobook. I asked if they could actually put in a laugh track in those sections, and they did. So the audiobook actually has like a laugh track, and then they took out the lines where the character it says that the laugh track is happening. Anyway, yeah. So.
As a completely weird aside, let me recommend a story by Dennis Etchison called Death Tracks. He's a horror writer. He most famously, I think, wrote the novel for Halloween, for
Oh,
the
wow.
original Halloween long ago. But in
Heads.
Death Tracks, it's about a guy who's a salesman and goes door to door, knocks somebody's door, enters this suburban house. They're all. The curtains are all drawn, they're glued to the TV, and they're watching the TV, and they just want to hear the laugh tracks of all the shows because their son was killed in Vietnam, and they want to find out how people could laugh like that during Vietnam. So they're
Ooh.
completely obsessed with what they call the death tracks. And
Whoa. Wow.
so there you
Very intense.
go.
Oof.
And as I say, you know, I think that your novel deals in this the same way. So I also really like, you know, going from these completely weird scenes that are in the AI world, the second world, imagined world where everybody gets on their smart suits and goes into these
Right,
worlds
yeah, the
where
smart
the
world,
And then it's what's really powerful is to go from that world and think, well, you know, we're practically there in front of our computers, or, and then to go from that world to that really kind of gritty world of, you know, walking in the suburb. When you use the word suburb, it really has a kind of an interesting power in this book because it emphasizes both what's really wrong, but what's really sweet and right in our memories about the suburbs
Right.
I
Like
grew up
there's something
in.
very quaint.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the suburbs in this book and the suburbs in your life.
Oh, the suburbs. Yeah, I grew up in obviously I grew up. Did we talk about the suburbs before in our I can't remember if we talked
No.
about it in other talks. So I grew up in the suburbs, and yeah, it's interesting, right? Like you can feel so critical about the suburbs and what they are. And even the suburb I grew up in was created through a lot of white flight out of Hartford, Connecticut, into these, you know, this kind of working class suburb, which was, you know, very, very racist in some, you know, so you can have that kind of critique of like what the suburbs are in American history, even writ large. But then it's where you grew up. It's where you fell in love for the first time. There is a coziness to the people there. I mean, the suburb I grew up in the people, it wasn't like you would ever see people really that I can remember, like out on the street mingling with each other. This was not like a backyard barbecue kind of suburb vibe. I don't know if yours was.
No, mine were strictly, you live next door to people and you waved at them as they mowed their lawn.
Yeah, there was a kind of distance and that feeling of driving down and like the houses kind of scrolling past, you know. So I think, yeah, there's a kind of chilliness to the suburbs, but I think for better or worse, my imagination locked in on that really hard when I was young. So I'm always going back to the suburb, and even the word suburb with the B's and the vowels in it. I mean, the word is kind of, you drop that in a sentence and all sorts of wonderful like audio kind of ripples out across the rest of the sentence. It's a very evocative word. So yeah, so I've studied the history of the suburbs and things like that. And it's a strange old place. I mean, I'm glad I don't live in one right now, to be honest, but it's yeah, I maybe at some point I won't be writing about the suburbs anymore. But for the moment, I seem to be imaginatively stuck there. And it does feel like a space representative historically in a way for like what we've done to ourselves as a society, because the suburbs are not something that grow up organically, really. They are sort of like a plan that's like placed upon a landscape with a specific purpose in mind, like a shopping mall or something. You know, it's not just like something that grows up, you know, casually through groups interacting with each other. You know, in most cases, people come in and say, we're going to make this suburb happen here. So yeah, you know, so I think there's something kind of dark and strange about that as well, because that all represents a kind of corporate, you know, greed and so forth. And, you know, it all comes out of the GI Bill. Anyway, I could talk about the suburbs for far too long, but I think I got about 19 points in there. I'm gonna shut up.
Well, you know, too, we were talking about terrorism earlier, and while Americans are plenty concerned about it, and we see it a lot elsewhere, it has happened here, but not very often. And one of the things this book makes that happen. And I'm wondering, you know, did you, as a writer, did you feel like worried that, you know, am I inviting terrorists into our country?
I don't know that literary fiction is influential enough for that to be a problem. Oh, you mean like, but like maybe my book is making such a strong argument for why there should be eco-terrorists that that people would read it and get out. Because I don't think the book, I think honestly, some of the reactions I've seen are, I've seen a few people say that I'm too hard on the eco-terrorists because the characters who try to engage with it end up having this horror of violence that they can't really, you know, and I think people have felt like I've been pretty critical of eco-terrorism. But I mean, yeah, you know, I suppose, you know, there is something where you're kind of leaving things a bit murky. It's interesting, though, what you say about terrorism, because I can remember being, I guess I was a sophomore in high school, I think, when mm-hmm. Columbine happened mm-hmm. and there was that mass shooting. And then just the rise in mass shootings and public violence happening all the time. So, I mean, I do feel in a way that my lifetime has been one where I've seen violence explode across the entire society in a way that's similar to what described in the book. But I guess in the book, there's an ideological focus to it where someone who goes in and like shoots up 50 people at like Pulse nightclubs. I mean, I think of these as terrorist attacks, but I think there are forces in our society and our media that are so strong that make it always like, oh, well, a lone gunman went in, where I think there's probably more of a loose kind of dark ideology that does unite all that kind of violence, that if we wanted to think of that as terrorism, we could call it that. Because it is coming from a similar place a lot of the times, this very hateful, conservative place of sort of isolated rage and lashing out. Yeah.
Killing people is never okay.
Was there something I said that?
No.
You're like, Scott, let's just take a moment and pause and remind our listeners, let's not murder anyone. And I think I totally agree with you.
I'm just trying
not
to.
Good.
I wasn't suggesting that either. Yes. I really like the feel of these of the scenery in this book.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did you like draw any of this out? Are you an artist? Did you do sketches? Did you hand the work to somebody and say, draw me a picture of this?
Gosh, that would have been great. No, I didn't. But I do. When I'm writing for some reason, the description, trying to like write about what things look like, I feel like it's almost like a separate side. It can sometimes feel like this separate side project from the book, because I'll just go off and I'll just spend forever trying to really, like, you know, write descriptive language. I love this visual sensory language so much, but I can get a little OCD about it. It can be a bit of a problem where, you know, probably, you know, the time it takes me to complete something stretches out so long because I'm just trying to like write about suburban houses in a way that feels new and vivid to me. You know, there's only so many ways maybe you can describe the suburbs. So, and I say this as coming from weeks of writing the short story now, where I'm just sitting there going like, they drove down the street, there are the houses, you know, and trying to say new things. Yeah.
Well,
but I love the visual in writing so much. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, as I said, this is a short, punchy, fast, page-turning read, and I think that it's interesting. I wouldn't really describe this as a thriller, although it has all the elements of a thriller, you know, because the emotional weight it carries is pretty heavy.
Thank you, Rick. That's nice. Yeah.
But also, I think that emotional weight rules, lets, you know, you're more... rhetorical arguments roll with it. It doesn't hold them behind, but you know, they've become involved. We care about the world more, and about, you know, the way things are headed more. You know, that we're headed toward, well, what do you call it? The big fire, the temperature leap.
Oh, the heat leap.
The heat leap.
Yeah. So there's all this different lingo in the book for things. So the people in the plastic world call climate change the heat leap. Yeah. And it's one word kind of mashed together. Heat leap. Yeah. Where the temperature is going up on them. And then their plastic skin, you know, is melting. And yeah.
Well, and that brings us to one of my favorite things. I think this is often mentioned by reviewers and interviewers, Brad Pitt disease.
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of like the cancer of the world in a way.
Yeah.
But it makes their plastic skin corrode to ash and things like that. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's just trying to, you know, and I mean, that's how Aaron's father dies, is of Brad Pitt disease. So the whole time he's dying, there's also this kind of like comic, like weird, like joke swirling around it too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting too when, you know, you talk about like you want the fiction to hurt or really cut, or like, you know, to really feel what's going on. I feel like comedy is one of the big ways to do it. You know, I think if we can, when we laugh at things, oftentimes that's a very deep emotional engagement we're having, where at the surface level, it's kind of like the irony or the disjunction that's amusing to us, where, you know, it's like, oh, people have this intense disease. Oh, it's called Brad Pitt disease. Ha 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 ha. But then underneath that, you're laughing and you're having that kind of visceral reaction to it. But then underneath it, it's sort of like, well, yeah, like the terrible sadness of death happens to us all. And then as human beings, we're left scrambling to like put words and names to it. And often that's very clumsy and odd with our culture. So, yeah, I think, you know, it wasn't until even later on I was able to figure out how to weave some comedy into the book that I was able to connect with the book deeply. Because when it was just this grim saga about a dystopian world, like I was saying, I felt a little unengaged with it, I guess, when I was writing it.
So the humor wasn't always part of it? I mean...
Oh, no. For many years. No, it started... That's the thing, is like it started out...
Oh, my God.
It started out a very grim dystopian book, not set in a plastic world at all. And then after a long break, I was like, you know what, maybe... all these characters could be plastic figure. You know, I had this kind of like wacky brainstorm for this book that wasn't quite working. And then once they became plastic characters, and once there was that whole odd plastic world that I could build around it, that gave me kind of an emotional entry point.
This book has lots of great songs in it.
Oh, thank you.
I love the lyrics. Talk about the decision to turn this into an album.
Yeah, you know, in many ways, I'm really just fascinated with the novel as a form, or the history of the novel as a form, where the novel kind of evolves, you know, in the, you know, I guess, like, you know, 16, 17, 1800s, you know, to sort of in that area, not as people sitting down like, let's write a novel. This is very clear to us what it is, but it's this kind of hodgepodge of all these different genres coming together. So some of the early novels are even like Robinson Crusoe or something, are even written as like travelogues, or they're epistolary, like Samuel Richardson novels, or, you know, you have something like Tristram Shandy, where all these different genres are coming together. So,
or Dracula.
Or Dracula. Yeah, exactly. No, yes. Yeah, so the early novel is this very undefined space, you know, or where there's this swirl of genres coming together. So I really love that feel, or that idea of what the novel can be as this capacious space that isn't just any one type of storytelling, or even sort of one mode of storytelling. So for me, once the characters in the book started expressing themselves in song, which I say that because Morris, the character Morris, one day just started singing, and I'm like, okay, Morris, you can have a song. And then Aaron wanted songs. And I think when you're spending so long alone with your characters, you do feel like them kind of like being like, hey, Scott, I'm doing this now, so you can do it or not, you know. So once music came into the book, I was like, oh, okay, let's do this, guys. And I really sound a little mentally unstable as I talk about this, but it is the imaginative journey. Once that all happened, then my, you know, then I started thinking like, oh, how interesting. Okay, so the characters will have songs. And then I was able to reach out to some incredible musician friends I knew, and, you know, an incredible producer, and start to create album version of the book. And then my publisher really beautifully was on board for that as well. So there's like a QR code on every physical copy of the book that takes you right to the album. And then the album takes you through the whole story, like in a song cycle of nine songs. It's about like 36 minutes long. So, and I mean, I think of all that, even the QR code, as part of the novel. And, you know, some of it takes you online in various ways. So I love that sense of, you know, the novel is this vast mode of storytelling that still isn't defined, even after hundreds and hundreds of years of being a form. And sure, and, you know, concept albums are modes of storytelling. I love so many different, you know, like the King's Arthur, you know, I love so many different concept albums, and those had a big influence on me as a writer as well. So, yeah, so it was really exciting to feel that all come together. And I just have to give like eternal props to Pantheon Books, that they have the ability to have you know, because this wasn't like I did when I sold the book, I wasn't like, oh, and there's an album. This was an idea that I had as we were working on it. And they were just excited to see it through and take it step by step all the way there. And I should say the names of the musicians I work with too, because Cinder Talk did so much of the music, and he is just an absolute genius. So Cinder Talk is like, you know, like the Ashes, Cinder Talk, and then Stranger Cat is the name of the singer. So it was a privilege to work with them on it.
The new novel and album by Scott Guild is Plastic. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you so much, Rick. This has been a delight. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.